Hello, and welcome to Modern American Diplomacy, a podcast exploring the lives and contributions of America's most accomplished career diplomats. I'm your host, Jeremy Beer, recording in Washington, D.C. Today, we're joined by Ambassador Nancy Jo Powell, one of the most distinguished diplomats in modern American history. Ambassador Powell served in the State Department with distinction for over 37 years, including assignments as the U.S. Ambassador to Uganda, the U.S. Ambassador to Ghana, the U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan, the U.S. Ambassador to Nepal, and as the first female U.S. Ambassador to India. In 2006, Ambassador Powell received one of the U.S. government's most prestigious awards, the Homeland Security Service to America Medal, for her work as the State Department's Senior Coordinator on the avian influenza epidemic. She was also asked to come out of retirement to coordinate the State Department's response to the 2014 Ebola outbreak. Ambassador Powell holds the rank of Career Ambassador, the highest rank in the United States Foreign Service. Ambassador Powell, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you again for joining us today. I'd like to start with your childhood, if we could. You were born in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and later moved to Lamars, Iowa, which is near the border with South Dakota. You earned a bachelor's degree in history and teaching from the University of Northern Iowa in 1970, and then you taught high school social studies in Dayton, Iowa, until you joined the Foreign Service in 1977. Outside of your Swedish-born grandmother and a few Danish neighbors, you've said you didn't really have a lot of exposure to foreign people or ideas or cultures growing up. What was the turning point that inspired you to leave rural Iowa and start down the path towards a career in international affairs?
I think there probably were a couple things. First of all, growing up in the 1950s with television, I think I was exposed to the news and the growing role of the United States on the world stage and the Cuban Missile Crisis, various things as I was growing up. But the big turning point came while I was teaching in Dayton, Iowa, which is a town of 900 people. And during the school year, I was quite content in my job. I liked it a lot. I worked well with the kids and with my fellow teachers. But during the summers, I sought some adventures. And one of the adventures turned out to be a trip sponsored by the United States government to Pakistan for 25 teachers from the Midwest. And we spent 8 weeks in Pakistan in 1975 as students, not as teachers. We went to learn how to teach better about the third world in our classroom. The money for this program came from the PL-480 Food for Peace money that was being spent in country. And at that time, I really learned what the Foreign Service was. The embassy was quite good about briefing us, talking informally about what they did and how they got to be where they were in Pakistan. And one of the gentlemen said, if you're interested, I can give you the application for the test. I didn't know what the test was, but I found out that there was a written test and then an oral test. So he very kindly helped me fill out the form and send it into Washington from Pakistan. And that started a journey toward the Foreign Service.
So in 1976, after your trip to Pakistan, you take and pass the Foreign Service exam and subsequently joined the 129th A100 class. That class had 37 people in it, only five of whom were women. Three of those female officers left the service relatively quickly, and one other female officer stuck it out with you, and that was Michelle Bond, who also became an ambassador and later assistant secretary for consular affairs. What was it like to join the predominantly male Foreign Service in the late 1970s? And what would you tell women listening to this program, either coming out of school or maybe looking at a career change, or even those who are current officers, about serving and succeeding in the State Department today?
Several things. First of all, I'll tell you a very funny story that happened on the first day of A100. We were welcomed by what I now know as the pale male Yale cohort of the State Department by a senior officer who proceeded to tell a very sexist joke. And when the first break occurred, the five women all fit into the bathroom at FSI, and we all looked at each other and said, what in the world was that? My superintendent or a fellow teacher in Iowa would be pilloried for saying something like that. And we wondered what we had gotten into. I must say it was atypical of the rest of the treatment that we got in A100. But it did register with all five of us. We were part of a generation that was coming in. The first lawsuit had been filed and won. So the State Department was aware that it had a discrimination problem and had to deal with it. I used to laugh that I thought I perhaps was a twofer with my geographic diversity. There were not many people from Iowa. It turned out there were more than I thought, but still not very many. Michelle was just out of school. But Michelle and I had kept in touch over the years and are still in touch every once in a while. And I was delighted to see her do so extraordinarily well and to be so important to me in India when she was in the consular assistant secretaryship.
You mentioned your first tour in Ottawa. When looking at a map, Ottawa is about as close to Cedar Falls as you can get for a foreign posting. Were you disappointed when you got assigned to Ottawa, or were you excited about that? What was that first tour like for you?
I was excited to go anywhere in the Foreign Service. I have subsequently joked that I joined the Foreign Service and went all the way to Canada. And my Canadian counterpart in New Delhi, 30-some years later, said, well, that's okay. I joined the Foreign Service and went all the way to San Francisco. It actually was a very, very good job for me in a number of ways. It was a rotation job. I did a year in the consular section and then 6 months in the economic section and 6 months in the political section. So I got a chance to see a great deal of how the embassy functioned. I got over the culture shock of joining a very bureaucratic organization and a federal government organization after having been in a town of 900. And I think that was critical. I didn't really have any culture shock. It was cold in Ottawa, but it was cold in Iowa. That wasn't a big deal for me. I thoroughly enjoyed learning to cross-country ski, and I skated every night on the canal. So it turned out to be an excellent position.
So for your second tour after Ottawa, you were assigned not to Canada, but to Kathmandu, Nepal. And that tour sort of helped shape and define the rest of your career as an expert in South Asia. What was it about that second tour that was so career-defining for you?
I had the opportunity as the head of the consular section to be responsible for supervising two absolutely wonderful Foreign Service nationals and a part-time backup American officer who was junior to me. I also sat on the country team, and it was a very, very fascinating seat. I watched three different ambassadors during my 2 years in Nepal with very different management styles and very different attitudes toward the Foreign Service, one political ambassador and two career people. I also met one of my chief mentors, Peter Burley, who came to Kathmandu as the DCM, and was extraordinarily helpful to Tom Krajewski, who was the other junior officer, and to me, and remained that way throughout my entire career. Plus, it was an absolutely incredibly fascinating part of the world, and one that I thoroughly enjoyed exploring. Peter had been a Peace Corps volunteer and a Fulbright scholar, and was very helpful in helping those of us who were interested in Nepal learn more about it. We had an incredibly close community. Kathmandu in 1980 had no telephone service to America. It had no television at all. So we played tennis. We played bridge. We went to the Marine House movies. We really had a very close set of people that are still very close. I count as some of my best friends people from that tour that was in 1980.
After that tour, you returned to Main State to work as the Nepal desk officer, and you also do some refugee assistance work. And after a few years in Washington, you returned to the field, but this time to Pakistan, where you're assigned as a political officer covering internal politics and also India-Pakistan relations in Lahore. This is the summer of 1988, and Ambassador Arne Raifel asks you to serve as the acting consul general in Lahore. It hadn't been long since Benazir Bhutto had returned from exile in London, so you're busily reporting on that development. You're planning for the arrival of a new consul general. You're dealing with a heavy workload, just given the summer turnover. You've got an inspection team on the ground. And then the U.S. Navy shoots down Iran Air Flight 655 in the Persian Gulf. And that stirs up a lot of anti-U.S. sentiment in the region. So that's a lot to handle in your first big management job. What was that period of time like? What did you do right as a manager? What did you do wrong? And why did that experience inspire you to assume other significant leadership roles in the department?
You quite well captured what was probably about a six-week period, but all of these various things happening. It was a second major turning point for me. I actually survived it and could say to myself, I can do this. I had a very good crew to work with. One of the people that arrived, I believe on the 1st of July, had been one of the hostages in Iran. And he came in as a political officer. And I think it was the 3rd of July that the airliner was shot down, and we knew we were in the soup. And he had been a security officer in Tehran and had accompanied the people to the foreign ministry. So he had been in the foreign ministry most of the time. But he and I, on the morning of the 4th of July, went to the consulate and did an inventory of all of the issues for security. And we had things like, in order to fill the fuel tank for the generator, people had made it possible so you could climb up on the roof. I could climb over the wall because it had holes in it. The keys were in the truck for the commissary so you could use it as a battering ram. It was just all kinds of things that were there. So I learned an enormous amount about security. I later was advised that there was some traffic that believed I was going to be the subject of a kidnapping by the Iranians. So I had my first security detail and learned to live with that whole piece. But as I said, it gave me the confidence to think that perhaps I could aspire to an executive role in the State Department. It was the first time I had really, really done that kind of work. And I got extraordinary support from Ambassador Rafel, from the acting DCM, from the security people, and from the team in Lahore. Plus, it turns out that the Pakistani community in Lahore, primarily business people, local politicians, were more than welcoming. And I really got a feel for Punjabi politics, which are so incredibly important to Pakistan, and enjoyed friendships that continue that I made during that time.
So after a stint as the CG in Calcutta, the MC for Political Affairs in New Delhi, DCM in Dhaka, and DCM in Lome, in 1997, you're nominated to become the U.S. ambassador to Uganda. And that's, I believe, your first ambassadorship. After Uganda, you come back to Washington, and you work in the AF front office for a few years as the PDAS, and then as the acting assistant secretary. And then you return to the field for a string of ambassadorships, U.S. ambassador to Ghana, U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, and then later in your career, you return to Nepal as ambassador and eventually go to India as the U.S. ambassador. Every single one of those jobs is incredibly demanding. You're working nights, you're working weekends, the issues you're dealing with are incredibly complex, often with life and death consequences, the relationships within your country team and with your respective host governments are often fraught and difficult to manage. You're wrestling with difficult personalities. Were there ever moments when you were managing these embassies in these difficult places where you said to yourself, you know what? This is not worth it. This is the last embassy I'm going to do. I think I'm just going to hang it up and I'm going to go back to Cedar Falls or move on and just do something else.
We all have those kind of days once in a while. I would be lying if I didn't say it crossed my mind every once in a while. And the only time I ever really said it was when I had already retired and was working on Ebola, and I would threaten that I was going back to my bench on the beach in Delaware. But most of the time, you have a responsibility, and I certainly was raised to believe that if you take on that responsibility, you need to try to fulfill it. And there's also the example that you set. If you're getting frustrated or you're getting upset by things that are happening outside that you really don't have any control on, then it spreads through the embassy. So there is a need to set an example, a role model for how to deal with some of these things.
The places where you served as ambassador, namely South Asia and Africa, are considered to be the most difficult places in which to serve. Yet, staff are often happier at embassies and consulates like that. Why do you think that is?
First of all, people self-select to go there. There are a few people that are assigned in order for the hardship differential. They haven't served in hardship posts, but by and large, people choose to do that. So they've come knowing what they're getting into. They tend to like their jobs, and there are opportunities. Most of the posts, with the exception of Pakistan and India, are medium-sized to small posts where people can know each other, they can socialize together, and it becomes, if you're at the bigger posts, India in some ways was this way, and it's my observation of posts like London or Paris that it's more like Washington. You have very good colleagues in the office, but at whatever time it is, I won't say 5 o'clock because nobody goes home at 5 o'clock. But when people go home, they go home to a different set of people. They're not interacting with them. They may not understand what's happening with their families. But I do think the self-selection of people that want to be at those posts, I personally found the issues, many of which were the same in both Africa and South Asia, particularly of development and democracy, to be very fulfilling to work on those. And once I got into the executive part, to be able to support the people at the AID mission or the Peace Corps. And I think other people found that as well in their own work.
You officially became U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan in the late summer of 2002. So that's about 1 year after 9/11. Before 9/11, Pakistan had been a favorite post for couples with young kids and for families. But after 9/11, al-Qaeda elements were flushed out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, and the country really became a hotbed for terrorism. Right before your arrival, an embassy employee and her 17-year-old daughter were killed after Islamic militants threw a grenade inside a Protestant church just a few hundred yards from our embassy. There were constant plots to bomb the U.S. consulate in Karachi during your tenure, and al-Qaeda operatives were regularly being arrested in Pakistan during that time, including some of the terrorists linked to the bombing of the USS Cole and the September 11 attacks. Describe for us what it was like to be the U.S. ambassador in that environment and what it was like to lead such a security and intelligence-driven country team in a critically important country like Pakistan in the wake of 9/11.
It was an incredible challenge, and it was a 24/7 challenge for all of us. In my first 2 weeks, I had a cable that I had not authorized that went all the way to the president who commented on it, and I had not seen it. On the second day I was there, one of the Marine officers came in and wanted to start an evacuation, and I'm like, what evacuation? And there clearly was a communication issue there. We already were down to having no spouses and family members at post. On my fourth day, Deputy Secretary Armitage came and negotiated a mechanism with the Pakistanis, which eventually allowed for both the Pakistanis and the Indians to withdraw from a border area where tensions were incredibly high between two nuclear powers. On day eight, Secretary Rumsfeld came. On day 10, CENTCOM commander came. And on day 12, they tried to blow up the consulate in Karachi. And you asked me earlier about those days where you say, maybe it's time to go home. And it's like, I gave up the beach in Ghana for this. I mean, but we worked really hard. The other thing that was happening when I arrived was that everybody was still very much in crisis mode. And we had to take a step back and say, actually, the crisis is past. We may have another one. But we don't need people sleeping in the embassy now. We don't need garbage left in the hallways. We don't need a lot of things that you did right after 9/11. We're going to have to go back to being a diplomatic post here with the regular protocols of being a diplomatic post. You cannot bring your firearms to country team. Some things like that of just trying to restore a sense of normalcy. And talking with people subsequently, I've been on some panels with people who tried to return their businesses to normal after 9/11 in New York. And it seems to me that after the crisis is over, getting things back to doing normal tasks in normal ways is one of the ways with coping. The other thing that was unique about Pakistan was just the incredible turnover. I don't believe that my weekly large country team meeting ever had the same people around the table 2 weeks in a row. People were rotating out. The military was only staying 6 months, including the generals that were overseeing the military presence. I arrived in June, so we had some of the regular summer turnover. I lost most of my country team within the first 3 weeks. So this constant churn of trying to develop a team, trying to develop some kind of esprit among the cohort, it added an element, and I think we did it quite well in Pakistan at that time. The ambassador's residence was absolutely made for doing entertaining. And we ended up doing a lot of dinners in the yard. We played miniature golf in the house. We did all kinds of things to try to bring people together. They decorated for Christmas with me. And this, I think, helped. And it's an important part of an ambassador's job anywhere, but particularly when your team is changing that often. You really have to work on it. We also worked to allow spouses willing to work in the mission to come back and join their spouse who was assigned to the mission. It's one of the things I'm very proud of having originated. It became a pattern for both Iraq and for Afghanistan. It also saved enormous amounts of money because TDYers were not having to fill those jobs. And it helped stabilize the embassy a little bit to have couples and people that were also willing to help mentor others inside the mission. The other thing I would say is that I had extraordinarily good partners for the most part from the other agencies, from the intelligence and law enforcement and military. We didn't always see eye to eye, and it took a little while to sort some things out. But by and large, we had a very, very good working relationship.
So after Pakistan, you're offered another ambassadorship, but you come back to Washington for family reasons, and you complete a brief stint in legislative affairs, and then you're asked to work in INL, and they slot you into the assistant secretary role for about 8 months. But then the avian influenza outbreak begins, and you're appointed as the State Department's senior coordinator for our avian influenza preparations. Later in your career, in about 2014, you're asked by President Obama to come out of retirement and lead the State Department's Ebola Coordination Unit. Based on those two experiences, you co-author an article titled Fighting Pandemics, Lessons Learned, in which you suggest there are going to be additional pandemics in the future, they're going to be increasingly complex, and they're going to cause significant economic and political instability if they're not quickly controlled. So you wrote that 3 years ago, yet here we are today, 12 months into the worst pandemic of the past 100 years. Why was our response to the COVID-19 pandemic so ineffective? Did we just get lucky with avian influenza and Ebola and Zika? Or were there a set of policies implemented during those crises that we failed to implement with COVID-19?
I think there's a number of answers to it. On the avian influenza, the State Department took the lead on it. I don't ever remember going to an NSC meeting on avian influenza. There were certainly input from the White House. I don't mean to suggest that, but it really stayed at the State Department. And it was a foreign policy issue. I traveled to talk to WHO, to the EU, to the UK. I went to China. I went to Japan. And we set up a global task force. The Chinese actually hosted the pledging conference and the World Bank funded it. So there was a very active effort almost from the very beginning for this to be a global response. And for the most part, it stayed out of the United States. So it really was a foreign policy issue. Part of the difference with Ebola was that you really, really have to work at catching Ebola in contrast to COVID or to avian influenza, which spreads much more easily. But it brought home that the United States is not immune. The key thing was that it was an all-of-government response, particularly for Ebola, and especially after it hit the United States, but even before that. Certainly with Ebola, President Obama was incredibly involved. The CDC, AID, FEMA, the U.S. military was incredibly helpful in the Ebola. They had the resources to deliver Ebola treatment units, to set them up. They might have been plywood, but they worked. They gave people a safe place to treat Ebola. They distributed PPE. So you need that entire system, and it has to be coordinated at the federal level. It was very obvious, at least from the outside, we did not take those same attitudes and roles with COVID.
One last question before we wrap up. In 2003, you received the Arne Raifel Award for your efforts to promote and develop the people around you, especially entry-level officers. And I've heard you say that the formal programs at the State Department for mentorship are important, but are less valuable than the mentoring done by immediate supervisors and senior advisors on an individual basis just in the course of work. Given the huge loss of talent within the State Department, particularly in the senior ranks over the past couple of years, how should we look to bridge that mentorship gap within the department? And how should we go about rebuilding?
The receipt of the Raifel Award, I consider to be one of the most important things that happened to me. I hold Ambassador Raifel in enormous esteem. It was one of the saddest days of my life on that day when the airplane crashed that killed him. And his example continued to inspire me as I worked my way through the State Department. I know that the current Director General is working on formal mechanisms to try to do this, but it really does put a premium on every single officer, whether they're civil service or foreign service, to work with their colleagues and to have exchanges. They don't have to be formal ones. I have done formal mentoring. I don't particularly think it's as effective as the example that you set. Sometimes that's how you mentor. Sometimes it's just putting your hand on somebody's shoulder and saying, do you need to go have a cup of coffee? But it has to be part of everybody's work. And I do sincerely believe this idea that if you're there 1 week, you have a better handle than somebody who just arrived yesterday. And given how often we move and how often we change jobs, that's critical to help people. The disruptions over the past few years, hopefully some of these people will come back. We're already seeing Linda Thomas Greenfield and Toria Newland and some of the others coming back. Secretary Blinken is not a Foreign Service officer, but he's had previous service. It's nice to have somebody who remembers how things work in the State Department and will bring that back with him.
Any final thoughts or words of wisdom or support that you'd like to deliver to folks out in the field?
Just the general reflection after being gone now for almost 7 years. It was a wonderful career. As I said, there were probably a few days when I was ready to pack it in and to get on the airplane and go home, but not many. And certainly the security that it's provided for my retirement is an added benefit. So please don't ignore that as you think about staying in the Foreign Service until your 20 years or 20 years plus are up. But I think this is a time that is critical for America. I believe that the phrase is that we're back at the table, we're back in the room where it happens. And I think being a part of that is just an incredible opportunity and something that you should treasure and thoroughly enjoy during your time with the State Department.
Ambassador Powell, on behalf of all of our listeners, our heartfelt thanks for joining us today. You can find more detail on Ambassador Powell's post-State Department career at the American Academy of Diplomacy. Special thanks to the Una Chapman Cox Foundation for supporting today's program. If you're interested in exploring a career in the Foreign Service, please visit careers.state.gov. To find out more about today's guest or to dig further into the history and practice of U.S. diplomacy, please visit uccoxfoundation.org or 25yearapprenticeship.com. A special thanks to the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training for providing much of the background for today's program. Please rate and review this podcast so that other folks interested in foreign policy and careers in the Foreign Service can find us. Thanks very much.